discovered the first case of the Omicron variant in the Gaza Strip, and this indicates that this variant was now spreading among the population. The discovery poses a new challenge to the enclave's weak health system. Omicron is a fast-spreading variant and highly infectious, and will be dominant among the coronavirus infections in the Gaza Strip.
The Israeli blockade and multiple wars have had a devastating impact on the well-being of people in the tiny coastal sliver. The Israeli regime also maintains tight restrictions on the entry of humanitarian supplies, including medicines and hospital equipment, to combat COVID-19 and its variants. People in Gaza are bracing themselves for the worst following the local discovery of the Omicron variant.
The Gaza Strip's health system is fragile because of the Israeli blockade. We are afraid of Omicron because we know that it is extremely lethal. Gaza is not prepared for Omicron, and we are praying for a miracle.
The Ministry of Health in Gaza needs all the support it can get in order to combat this deadly variant. We don't have enough hospital beds or medicines because of the Israeli blockade. We call on all international organizations to help us combat the coronavirus, especially the Omicron variant.
The Israeli regime has compounded the risk of coronavirus infection for over 2 million Palestinians living in Gaza, making it extremely difficult to combat the deadly pandemic.
Israeli inhumane practices have battered Gaza's health system. Experts say that the Omicron variant will only worsen the health situation in the blockaded enclave. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
If the truth is not clarified today, the place of the oppressors and the oppressed will be changed. December 12, 2021. This is the part of a speech delivered on December 12, 2021, by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in meeting with a number of nurses and the families of those martyred while working in the health profession.
The great person, Zainab alayhi salam, showed two points. The first point is that women can be a vast ocean of patience and endurance. And the second point is that women can be a peak of wisdom and prudence. Zainab al-Kubra, peace be upon her, demonstrated these in practice. And not just to those who were living in Kufa and Sham, she showed this to history and all of mankind. As for her patience and endurance, the patience and endurance that Zainab al-Kubra showed and the tragedies she faced cannot be described at all. Firstly, she showed great endurance in the face of the martyrdoms.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
in about half a day or less than a day, 18 of her dear ones and relatives were martyred. One of these was her noble brother, God's proof on earth, the master of the martyrs, peace be upon him. These people were martyred in front of her eyes. Her two children were martyred as well. But she endured all of these. A mountain would collapse in the face of such tragedies. But Zainab al-Kubra was able to show patience and endurance and to carry out her subsequent duties with the inner strength that she possessed. If she had been impatient, wild, and shown restlessness, she would have not been able to deliver those speeches and to launch the great movement. So one point is her patience in the face of the martyrdoms. She also showed patience in the face of insults. A lady who had lived with dignity from the time she was born and whom everyone had held in high regard from her childhood to her adulthood was insulted by those thugs and ruffians in the Umayyads' army. But she was patient and did not break down.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The 8th round of the Vienna talks in Austria is approaching a break before it resumes after the new year. This continuation and the pace of progress is viewed as positive by Iran and some other signatories to the JCPOA agreement, but not for the party that pulled out, namely the U.S., which has said that the pace of the talks is too slow. Why is the U.S. in what appears to be a rush, unlike its position when the talks began? Just one of the questions we'll be asking in this edition of The Spotlight. We are here to talk to our correspondent in Vienna, Homolesky, for the latest on the talks.
As of now, Iran is saying that it will is sticking to its position of wanting verification and guarantees from the Americans when it comes to sanctions removal. It says these are the proposals that it's put forward, and Iran's team says it sees this as a good sign that the other side, the other parties, have acknowledged that this is and should be part of the negotiations. Because initially, we're talking earlier, you told me about this criticism against the French delegation. It looks like, for instance, initially that delegation and the other Europeans were not even willing to consider these issues to be on the agenda. Then there was some progress made. These were issues that were included. You know, when we're talking about why Iran is insisting on this verification and guarantee issue, we know that when the JCPOA was signed in 2015, what happened was that the Trump administration withdrew in 2018 without giving Iran the economic benefit, and on top of that, imposed the maximum pressure policy on the country, and secondary sanctions that also stopped any other European or international countries, firms or companies from working with Iran. So in spite of all that, Iran stayed committed to its obligations for another whole year, and then it started gradually withdrawing from the JCPOA itself. And now Mr. Barghari is saying because it was the U.S. that violated the deal, there is, of course, this leads to a lack of trust between the two sides. What's important for Iran, if it, that trust is going to be built, is to get this effective guarantee and verification.
Okay, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have Saeed Mohsen Abbas, journalist and political commentator, who joins us from London. Also joining us is Frank Emspach, who's a political analyst, joins us from Madison.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome both of you to this edition of The Spotlight, and I'd like to first start with you, Saeed Mohsen Abbas. What is the reason for the what appears to be these time constraints in the negotiations, which is coming from what is the U.S. side in particular? Are we looking at something that they are not seeing when it comes to the others who are saying that the pace of the negotiations in this eighth round is going rather well?
Well, I think we know what the attitudes of the Americans is, and we know who's pulling the strings behind the Americans. It is Israel, and Israel has stated very clearly they want these negotiations to fail. They have no intention of allowing America to come into an agreement. Now, it's a question of whether the U.S. really has real autonomy and the courage to be able to take the right stand, the just stand, the stand which will bring far more stability to the Middle East, or whether they're going to continue listening to their advisors in Tel Aviv, who seem to want a complete collapse of the JCPOA agreements from the day dot. Of course, the fact is that Iran has done everything it can in order not to pull out of these agreements, in spite of the fact that not only did the Americans pull out unilaterally completely from this agreement which they signed, they also made sure that the Europeans would be very, very scared to do anything without them, given all the sanctions that they were imposing and all of the other sanctions they were willing to impose on European businesses. So, of course, Iran is absolutely right to demand, literally demand, the Americans show cleanly how they're going to abide by whatever agreement emerges, if it emerges. So in the first place, getting to an agreement is first of all, the obligation of the Americans primarily, because they're the ones who pulled out completely. What can they put on the table to assure Iran that they will do what everybody else agrees at this juncture?
Well, Frank Emspach, what they can do is they can reach an agreement in some respects, and the best and quickest way is to lift the sanctions and the post-sanctions and then to return to their obligations under the agreement if they're so in a rush for time here, as they have stated, in particular the U.S. So why don't they do that?
Well, because I think that the United States is a past master in public relations, and the way they have in the press today, or at least the broadcast media, in the print media, incidentally, there was nothing today in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or any local press about the talks, which is, I thought, sort of interesting. But in any event, the way it's placed here is that somehow the Iranians are at fault for not agreeing right away. I think, though, that although Israel certainly is playing a role here, there's no question about that, I also think that it's not a good idea to underestimate the strength of the anti-Iranian sort of pro-Cold War sort of old-fashioned wing of both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And then when we get to guarantees legally in the United States, I think what it's hard to understand is that, yes, you can have a president saying, I signed something. But what really is the law is when the Senate passes this as a treaty. And I think the Biden administration, even those that might want to work out something with Iran, have a real problem here, because it's unlikely that a treaty could be voted on in the Senate as things stand now. And of course, in about 8 months or 10 months, when there's elections, it may change even more so for the worst. So there's a real problem here on the guarantee issue. That's the first thing. The second thing is that I do not see, and this is a great source of worry to any of us who would like to go back to the treaty, there is very little discussion or push, at least publicly, within the Democratic Party to move forward here. It's almost as if these negotiations are going on in some closet someplace and nobody knows much. But you don't hear anything. You don't see much from the administration. And there does not seem to be a vocal group in the Senate saying we should get this done. And that is a real source of concern, at least to me.
Why is that?
Well, I think that a couple of reasons, that the Iranian issue has not risen to the surface in a certain way. I think that the Democrats want to avoid it, and I think people are frightened in another way. You have the administration hinting that if things don't work out, maybe there'll be some kind of war. Nobody wants that. And so, in a certain sense, one way to try to deal with it is never to discuss it. I don't think that's going to, that's very helpful.
Okay, well, let me see what Seyed Mohsen Abbas thinks. Let's see what Seyed Mohsen Abbas thinks. Seyed Mohsen Abbas, our guest there, Frank Enspach, says it doesn't seem like there's a sense of urgency, or, if I can say that, or that the Democrats don't seem to really be reacting the way they should in terms of for this thing to happen. But isn't that sending a wrong signal, in a sense? Or it seems like the mind is not made up. On the one hand, the Americans accuse Iran, they're wasting time, they're not reaching an agreement, they're on their path to a nuclear bomb. And on the second hand, they just don't seem to be sending signals as to what direction they want this to go. At least from the outside looking at, that's what it appears. Do you see it that way?
I tend to agree with you. The thing that is really a problem for them is that Iran has a ballistic missile capability which is second to nobody in the Middle East, certainly in West Asia, and they're ranking right up there amongst all of the big guns of the world in terms of being able to land heavy-hitting, defense missiles on anybody who decides to attack them. And this is the only thing, I think, other than perhaps China and Russia being supportive of the Islamic Republic of Iran, which prevents or has prevented the Americans doing exactly what the Israelis want and exactly what the pro-Israel lobby wants them to do, which is to launch an attack on the Iranians and to knock out those nuclear installations which they claim are ready to produce weapons level, if you like, capability. Now, the reality, in fact, is that deterrent makes it, I think, almost impossible for either the Israelis or the Americans to really consider a strike without serious consequences. I mean, Iran has made it patently clear that anything that happens of that kind will result in Tel Aviv knowing about it. They'll certainly be able to reach Tel Aviv with their weaponry. I think this is the key, that the Americans are therefore panicking, and so are the Israelis, because they don't really have the negotiation chips really on the ground to be able to make their threats pay.
Well, let's see what Frank Enspach thinks here. I'm sorry to jump in. Just to get an idea about that point being made, Frank Enspach, that Seyed Mohsen Abbas, about Iran's, in a sense, military might overall. And I'd like to ask you about how it is, if it's connected in any sense, where you have these military drills that Iran just held, and it ended 5 days ago. They were massive. There were extensive military drills along the coastlines. And just a few days later, you have the headlines that came out, which said that, for example, one of them, about Israel Bennett, Israel is not opposed to a good nuclear deal, as he calls it, with Iran. I mean, I don't know if that's a coincidence or not, but, you know, we have had so many threats, which are illegal, coming from Israel against Iran, and then now this headline came out, and this comes out from an Israeli publication.
Yeah, well, it comes up and it says an agreement that they would agree to, that they like. So who knows what that is? I think Israel was clear yesterday morning when they attacked Syria on the basis that there might be an Iranian cargo ship or an Iranian container containing military spare parts that the Syrians need. So they blew up the Syrians' container port. I think that's what really Israel is. I think what's going on here is something that's really fundamental to the way in which the United States has conducted foreign policy for many, many years. And that is that they're faced with a group of people, the Iranians here, who have an independent view of how they want the world to run, which is different than the United States' view. And that the United States has had a hard time accepting that over the years. And I think that's a real fundamental and unspoken part of the American thinking. And when you read their documents, you see that. Like, who are these people? Who do they think to tell us what to do? You know, take the overall situation. The United States is trying to get Ukraine, which was part of the Soviet Union, you know, 50 years ago, 30 years ago, to join NATO. Can you imagine what would happen here if the Canadians were in a military alliance with somebody? People would be hysterical here. And I think that there is just simply no willingness on the part of the administration, any administration, to begin to really think about what it's going to be like not to be the top dog 100% of the time telling everybody what to do. And there's a strong, strong cultural bias here in that regard. And that is what is so difficult here, because it has to be overcome if we're going to get a treaty.
Well, I mean, this is not what Iran is saying, Saeed Mohsin Abbas. I'm looking at the Iranian foreign minister, Amir Abdullahian, in his most recent statements. The negotiating sides have reached a unified joint text, which is currently the focus of the Iranian team, along with things like the negotiations are moving in a good direction, an agreement is possible if other parties show goodwill and seriousness. So either there's a disconnect, either there's something that's going on behind closed doors. Of course, Iran doesn't talk directly with the U.S., that the U.S. doesn't want the world to know, because we're looking at almost opposite ends of the spectrum here in terms of what's being relayed out of the Vienna talks.
Yes, I think the Iranians have taken a tactical decision to keep upbeat, to be positive, to go in with all, if you like, options open. And they've been trying to, do the best they can, I think, for the original agreement to be re-ratified. What's happening minutiae in the details is rather irrelevant, to be honest. I would say the fact of the matter is that Iran will never completely pull out from wanting its ability to use nuclear technology for peaceful means. That's perfectly legitimate and absolutely fine. It will, I think, sincerely pull out of making it any of their nuclear program weapons capable or, you know, nuclear armed. I think that's been made clear by the leader, Sayyid Ali Khamenei, time and time again, that there is an actual religious edict which everybody chooses to ignore. And, the supreme leader has made it clear that he regards nuclear weapons and the scholars that basically preside over Iran's, future and its foreign policy and welfare based on moral, ethical grounds. They don't want the weapon. They say the nuclear weapon targets civilians, women and children, and on those grounds, Iran simply doesn't want it. I take Ayatollah Khamenei's word very seriously. The Americans and the Israelis clearly can't, because that's the kind of politics they play. They don't believe anything a moral, ethical man or administration says.
Trying to follow some logic, Frank Imspach, and I'm looking again at one of the U.S. positions that has been actually reiterated at some points especially in the beginning of the talks, and that is that they've said we have a long way to go to revive the JCPOA. When they talked about how 5 months has passed, and this is with the new Iranian administration coming into work, they had this positive spin on it, so to speak, but saying that we have a long ways to go. Almost at every turn, this was reiterated. But now they're saying, why aren't we reaching a point, whether it's an agreement or a disagreement? Again, trying to figure out the U.S. position here and as to why they're taking this most recent stance, which is that they're not the discussions are not moving, or the talks are not moving fast enough.
It's hard to know, but I mean, obviously when the Biden administration came into power last January, they could have moved very quickly by simply beginning to alleviate and raise and eliminate some of the sanctions, and they chose not to do that. And I think that those who have said that the United States' initial game plan was to try what Trump was doing was right, that's what we, the United States government, tried to do, and it didn't work. So now there's a problem as far as they're concerned. But again, the fundamental question is, are they committed to a treaty? And is there political pressure here to do it? Or, in fact, are they looking over their shoulder and that they're more worried about the political pressure from the right and from a certain segment of the Democratic Party not to do it? Because the obvious propaganda attack on Biden is going to be that somehow or other he lost Iran as if it was his in the first place. Sure. And you're going to see this kind of political attack here. And I think they have not come up with a the solution to it internally.
Uh-huh. All right. Let me ask the final question to Say Mohsen Abbas. You know, if I'm the Iranian team listening to what Frank Imspach is saying, the Democrats, well, maybe they don't really want a deal or they don't want an agreement. I would obviously ask for what Iran has asked for, and that is that guarantee as to whether the U.S. is going to stay in this agreement. How do you think that can come about? Do you think it will come about? And do you think that agreement at this point is even feasible?
My opinion is that Iran doesn't care. Iran doesn't care if America comes back into this deal or not. The Islamic Republic of Iran has made it patently clear that they can return if they lift those sanctions, those internationally illegal sanctions, which the Americans have gone absolutely crazy. In history, I don't think any nation, perhaps other than Nazi Germany, has had the scale of sanctions imposed by the Americans on a global level as Iran has in this instance. And what is it merited for this? It's basically developing nuclear, if you like, technology which allows it to use it as energy. For that crime, supposed crime, they've gone to all these lengths. So, of course, there's something more going on. The reality of the situation is why Iran doesn't really care, in my opinion, is that they've already started making huge inroads into alternatives. They don't need the West now. They don't need economically to be with the West. It's fine if it happens, great. But the future for Iran is Eurasia. It's China and Russia. And the more the Americans play this belligerent game of economic sanctions, more they're pushing nations like Iran into the arms of rising China and re-emerging Russia. That ultimately is where the future lies.
Thank you so much. We're fresh out of time, but I do thank Say Mohsen Abbas there with his comments, journalist and political commentator from London. Frank Imspach, a pleasure. Thank you so much. Political analyst there from Madison.
Thank you.
And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikhail Tahway, the entire team, it's goodbye until next time.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Thank you. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Former U.S. prosecutors say if the 6th of January panel finds new evidence about former President Donald Trump's role interfering with Congress's job to certify Joe Biden's election, that could help buttress a potential case by the Department of Justice. We now present you an article written by Peter Shaw. The piece is titled, Legal experts say Trump could face charges for trying to obstruct certification of election. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Former prosecutors and other experts say expectation is growing that former U.S. President Donald Trump might face charges for trying to obstruct Congress from certifying Joe Biden's election this year as a House panel collects more evidence into the 6th of January attack on the Capitol. Speculation about possible charges against the former U.S. President Donald Trump has been heightened by a recent rhetorical bombshell from Republican Representative and 6th of January panel Vice Chair Liz Cheney, suggesting the House panel is looking at whether Trump broke a law that bars obstruction of official proceedings. Former prosecutors say if the panel finds new evidence about Trump's role interfering with Congress's job to certify Joe Biden's election, that could help buttress a potential case by the Department of Justice. Department of Justice veterans say in varying ways, Liz Cheney's comments have been echoed by two other members of the House Select Committee, Republican Adam Kinzinger and Democrat Jamie Raskin, spurring talks of how an obstruction statute could apply to Trump, which would entail the panel making a criminal referral of evidence for the Justice Department to investigate. Former Justice Department officials say Liz Cheney's remarks raising the specter of criminal charges against Donald Trump came twice earlier this month at hearings of the committee. Experts believe the charges could be well-founded given Donald Trump's actions on 6th of January, including incendiary remarks to a rally just before the Capitol attack and failure to act for hours to stop the rioting. Former Department of Justice Inspector General and former prosecutor Michael Bromwich, in a statement to The Guardian, said, "Based on what is already in the public domain, there's powerful evidence that numerous people in and out of government attempted to obstruct, and did obstruct at least for a while, an official proceeding, that is, the certification of the presidential election." Michael Bromwich added, "That is a crime." Former prosecutors say although a House panel referral of obstruction by Donald Trump would not force the Department of Justice to open a criminal case against him, it could help provide more evidence for one and build pressure on the Justice Department to move forward. Attorney General Merrick Garland has declined to say so far whether his department may be investigating Donald Trump and his top allies already for their roles in the Capitol assault. The panel has amassed significant evidence, including more than 30,000 records and interviews with more than 300 people, among whom were some key White House staff. The evidence against Donald Trump himself could include his actions at the Stop the Steal rally not far from the White House, where he urged backers to march to the Capitol and fight like hell, or you're not going to have a country anymore. Donald Trump then resisted multiple pleas for hours from Republicans and others to urge his violent supporters to stop the attack on the Capitol. Recent ruling by Trump-appointed district court judges have supported using the obstruction statute, which federal prosecutors have cited in about 200 cases involving rioters charged by the Department of Justice for their roles in the Capitol assault that injured about 140 police officers and left 5 people dead. Still, experts note that the House panel's mission has been to assemble a comprehensive report of what took place on 6th of January and work on legislation to avoid such assaults on democracy. They caution that any criminal referral to Department of Justice documenting Trump's obstruction of Congress will take time and more evidence to help bolster a Department of Justice investigation. Some Department of Justice veterans say that any referral to Department of Justice by the House panel for a criminal case against Donald Trump and perhaps top allies such as former Chief of Staff Mark Meadows, whom the House recently cited for criminal contempt for refusing to be deposed, might also include Trump's aggressive pressuring of federal and state officials before 6th of January to block Joe Biden's election win with baseless charges of fraud. Bromwich stressed that evidence is steadily accumulating that would prove obstruction beyond a reasonable doubt. The ultimate question is who the defendants would be in such an obstruction case. Evidence is growing that, as a matter of law and fact, that could include Donald Trump, Mark Meadows, and other members of Trump's inner circle. Liz Cheney teed up the issue about Trump's potential culpability first at a House panel hearing recently, when she urged that Mark Meadows be held in contempt for refusing to be deposed, and then hit Donald Trump with a rhetorical bombshell. Liz Cheney said, "We know hours passed with no action by the President to defend the Congress and the United States from an assault while we were counting electoral votes. Did Donald Trump, through action or inaction, corruptly seek to obstruct or impede Congress's official proceeding to count electoral votes?" Liz Cheney's comments about Donald Trump are very precise, including language from the criminal obstruction statute, and she stated that her question is a key one for the panel's legislative task. Democrat Senator Jamie Raskin, too, has told the website Politico that the issue of whether Donald Trump broke the law by obstructing an official proceeding is clearly one of the things on the mind of some of the members of the House committee. Paul Rosenzweig, a former Department of Justice prosecutor who worked on Ken Starr's team during the impeachment of former President Bill Clinton, said, "The possibility of obstruction charges is legally valid," noting that the two district judges appointed by Donald Trump have recently said that the statute covers the efforts on 6th of January to stop the electoral count. For instance, Judge Dabney Friedrich, in a recent opinion, rejected the claim for some defendants who were challenging the Department of Justice's view that the 6th of January meeting of Congress fit the legal definition of an official proceeding. Rosenzweig posited that given Donald Trump's various attempts before 6th of January to undermine the election results, a broader conspiracy case may be another option for prosecutors to pursue. Former prosecutors say, should Department of Justice look at broader conspiracy charges, Donald Trump's persistent pressures on acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen and his top deputy for help blocking Joe Biden's election victory would probably be relevant. On one call on 27th of December 2020, Donald Trump pressed Jeffrey Rosen and his deputy to falsely state the election illegal and corrupt, despite the fact that the Department of Justice has not found any evidence of widespread voter fraud. Paul Peltier, a former acting chief of fraud section at Department of Justice, said that Liz Cheney's statements were carefully crafted and obviously based upon evidence the committee had seen. Should Congress ultimately refer the case to Department of Justice for investigation and prosecution, the Department of Justice's investigation would not be limited to a single obstruction charge, but would more likely investigate broader conspiracy charges, potentially involving Donald Trump and other key loyalists. The panel has accelerated its pace recently by sending out dozens of subpoenas for documents and depositions, some to close Donald Trump aides. Mark Meadows has become a central focus of the inquiry, in part over tweets he received on and near the insurrection that are among approximately 9,000 documents he gave the panel, much to Donald Trump's chagrin. As Trump's effort to thwart the panel from moving forward have had limited success, he has relied on sending out splenetic email attacks, including one recently that read, "The Unselect Committee itself is rigged, stacked with never-Trumpers, Republican enemies and two disgraced rhinos, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger, who couldn't get elected dogcatcher in their districts." Despite Donald Trump's angry attacks on the panel, some former prosecutors say that prosecuting Trump, if enough evidence is found to merit charges, is important for the health of American democracy. Former Georgia Attorney General Jay Moore told The Guardian, "I hate to think of a legal system that would allow the most powerful person in the country to go unchallenged when he has abdicated his highest priority, that being to keep American citizens safe. Donald Trump's conduct on that day was not unlike a mob boss."
Saudi Arabia. The autocratic kingdom is entertaining the world to see the other way when its leaders are overseeing the gravest violations of human rights at home and abroad. On December 6th, the first ever film festival kick-started in Jeddah, the second largest city in Saudi Arabia. a number of Arab and world celebrities walked the red carpet in astonishment, as they couldn't believe their own eyes. Open with much fanfare, the festival has yet another side underreported. The event was held in the teeth of calls from rights groups that considered it as an attempt by Riyadh to whitewash its grave violation of human rights.
Well, I think the whole issue around culture and politics is very important. One of the greatest freedom fighters that America has ever produced, Malcolm X, once said that if you don't stand for anything, you'll fall for everything. And I think in this situation, there is whitewashing going on. We know that Saudi Arabia has a human rights abuse history, and we know about the war in Yemen. So to pretend those things don't exist and for the normalization of relations to be pursued by the people who are going to the festival, I think is a mistake, and it's immoral.
Detentions and beheadings of political dissidents at home, hunting them down abroad, manifested in the gruesome murder of Jamal Khashoggi, as well as fanning the flames of war in the region, including the bloody campaign against Yemen, are all but a few examples of rights abuses committed by the Saudis. Over the past few years, Saudi Arabia has hosted a number of glitzy galas with the aim of offering a more palatable image of itself. But at the same time, the noose around political freedom has increasingly tightened. In the words of Madawi al-Rashid, who teaches at the London School of Economics, a film festival without freedom of expression quickly descends into propaganda. Sport and art will never be a substitute for real reform that includes civil and political rights.
Well, the film industry is a huge commercial cultural enterprise. It's part of certainly U.S. hegemony, and we can be under no illusion that the role of film and Hollywood in particular is to shine the light away from what's really going on in the world and to basically give people escapism and entertainment. Now, there's nothing wrong with being entertained, but when that's at the cost of the reality, and the reality in this case is that people have been tortured in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is engaging a war against Yemen.
The Canadian filmmaker Sami Khan, whose film St. Louis Superman was an Academy Award nominee in 2020, was among artists who boycotted the festival. He said, "The international film community should not allow itself to be bought and used by Saudi Arabia to whitewash horrific atrocities. I probably will pay a price for this, but I'm increasingly disturbed by the way repressive governments are using the global film industry to launder their reputations."
I think it's really incumbent on anybody that works in culture and film to take a stand. And I don't think anybody who's gone there has gone there with the intention of supporting those who would criticize Saudi Arabia. If there was a movement within Saudi Arabia that was resisting against the brutality of the government, of the regime, then perhaps the argument could be that those filmmakers are going there to support those individuals, but there's no evidence of that whatsoever.
In addition to Sami Khan, the British movie critic Hannah Ines Flint, the Syrian filmmaker Orwa Nairabia, also called for boycotting the festival on humanitarian grounds. Nairabia believes that the Saudi regime is trying to buy out the silence of the film industry over its atrocities by offering career opportunities. Back in 2019, he wrote, "I trust that the indecent proposal of throwing millions of dollars on the table will not blind everybody and will not make everybody join the choir of this facelift, this cover-up." The Syrian filmmaker pointed that out a few months after the Winter at Tantora Festival. Started for the first time in December 2018 in the wake of the murder of Khashoggi, the festival attracted some of the world-class musicians and a fast track to restore the kingdom's tarnished reputation. Earlier this month, Khashoggi's fiancé publicly asked the Canadian singer Justin Bieber to cancel his performance at the Formula One Saudi Arabian Grand Prix in the same city, Jeddah. Hatish Cengiz wrote, addressing the Canadian Star, "If you refuse to be a pawn of MBS, your message will be loud and clear. I do not perform for dictators. I choose justice and freedom over money."
Well, I think it's up to individual artists and athletes or anybody within the field which would be called non-political to actually admit the fact that any action that they take can be interpreted as political, as in fact is political. And I think the fundamental question that we have to ask ourselves as artists, as journalists, as filmmakers, particularly in the case of Saudi Arabia, is that, you know, a journalist, Khashoggi, was murdered by the Saudi authorities, apparently at the instruction of the leader of Saudi Arabia. And yet, for us to know that, but to conveniently forget it in this situation, I think is unacceptable.
A few days before the Red Sea Festival opened, Saudi Arabia was scrambling to handle another controversy over the Formula One race, which the kingdom was to host for the first time. Ahead of the race, F1 world champion Lewis Hamilton said he was not comfortable competing in Saudi Arabia, given its human rights conditions. Dozens of rights groups had already called on Hamilton to continue raising issues of human rights in the kingdom.
Well, big budgets don't make great films. They may make big films, but they're not necessarily great. And we've seen in the history of cinema over the past 100 years, in many countries across the world, where artists have managed to use cinema to express the feeling of the people, to express things which may not be easy to say in normal channels. And so one would hope that there are artists in Saudi Arabia, and I'm sure they are, who will try to speak about what is unspeakable, who will try to show what has not been shown, and will try to say what cannot be said. And I think if they took a step forward, it would be a much better situation than people from, particularly from the West, going in to celebrate a situation in Saudi Arabia which shouldn't be celebrated.
It wasn't centuries ago when artists and celebrities distanced themselves from the kingdom after the killing of the Saudi journalist. But now, once again, the emerging festivals in Saudi Arabia are being studded with stars who cannot resist the lure of Saudi petrodollars. It seems as if they're trying to get a slice in a kingdom where money abounds, but religious and political plurality is practically non-existent.